Bell, case number 3, and that is the United States versus Sheila Swan. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Barbara Klein, and I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant Sheila Swan. The government's theory in this case was that Sheila Swan's company, A1 Home Healthcare, claimed ghost employees when seeking Medicare reimbursement. Now, the government's case proved that 3 individuals performed little or no work at the company's offices, and the government also proved that reimbursement claims were submitted for those 3 persons. The government's proof about intent, however, was extremely sparse.
Well, I'm having a little trouble with that, I have to say, because, you know, here you're suggesting that the government's case as to her intent was, you know, weak. But don't these fraudulent billings in and of themselves bespeak an intent to defraud the government? How could her firm be billing the government with an innocent intent?
Well, Your Honor,
for services that were never performed by people who weren't her employees. I really have a problem.
If I may address that, first of all, the billings, where there was no evidence that Sheila Swan had anything to do with the cost reports, which were what was given in relation to the reimbursement. She did not sign those reports, and she had nothing to do with those reports, and she testified she really didn't even understand those reports. So it was the actual billing that was the fraudulent act, and she had nothing to do with that.
Is she the co-owner of this company?
Yes.
She knew who wasn't working there, didn't she?
Well, yes.
But she knew they weren't working.
Well, Your Honor, she did testify, and she believed there were some that weren't, but she continued to believe that some work was performed.
Well, she must have been standing in the corner looking out our window. I mean, they said they didn't do any work. They weren't there.
If I may, this is why the issue of intent is so important, because we know that if someone owns a business, they can have people, relatives, friends, whomever they want, who can be on the payroll and
As long as they don't bill the government for the cost of what they're doing, they might be able to get away with that baloney because it's their money.
Well,
now we're talking about the government money.
Well, that's exactly right. That's why
that's the intent.
Right, but Your Honor, as I said, there was the strongest evidence that there was intent was
that they submitted the bills to the government and the government paid them.
Well, as I said, Sheila Swan, there was no evidence shown that she had anything to do with that billing process. And there's also, I get to my second point, actually, that the Medicare regulations in the system is extremely complicated. Especially during that time, there was a changeover in the
agency. It's complicated so you can submit reports or bills on people that didn't work there and say that it was too complicated for you to figure out they weren't working there?
No, I'm saying if that was done fraudulently, there had to be the intent to do it. That is, we have to rule out mistake, negligence.
What intent would you ascribe to that? They sent in the bills. She's a co-owner. They send the bills to the government. The government pays it for people who didn't work. Weren't there. Didn't have anything to do with it.
Well, although she was the co-owner, there was the testimony was very clear that she had no knowledge about the cost report or reimbursement.
I mean, that's what she said.
Well, not only did she say that, but even the government's evidence showed that she did not sign those reimbursements, and there was no evidence whatsoever that she had anything to do with it. And that's why the admission of the statement by the agent was so damaging. That was the case in which...
Well, you got an uphill struggle on that one. There's a case right on point. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, Your Honor, basically, that should not have... That was extraordinarily damaging because of the lack of other intent. The attorney, Mr. Marzuski, was not acting as her agent at the time. He was merely responding. He was an attorney in a firm that was responding to a document subpoena.
You know, I didn't see anywhere in the transcript of Mr. Marzuski where either defendant put Judge St. Eve on notice of the type of objections you're making now. For example, that the government did not lay an adequate foundation for the notion that he was speaking as Ms. Swan's agent or that he was a breaching the attorney-client privilege. I mean, that is waived, it seems to me.
Well, Your Honor, I believe it was brought up at the trial, but it was also specifically laid out in the motion for a new trial. And, in fact, an affidavit from Mr. Marzewski was submitted. In that affidavit,
but the objection originally was hearsay, that's all.
I believe it was hearsay, but also that no foundation had been laid. It was that no foundation had been laid that he was an agent of Sheila Swan. That was brought up at the trial as well.
He was not the lawyer for the firm?
No, he was not. His only role in this was to respond to a document subpoena, and that he never indicated that he was representing Sheila Swan in any way.
He said he was representing the people that had the document subpoenaed.
He was an attorney at a law firm.
Yeah.
And as you know, in their other cases, it showed that that's a limited role that we have. And now we're getting into other sort of statements allegedly made in a casual conversation.
Am I absolutely off the wall believing that it was counsel for Swan's co-defendant, who was her husband, who objected to the testimony? I don't see any.
Absolutely correct.
Right. So Swan's counsel didn't join in the objection or make a separate objection on behalf of Ms. Swan.
Your Honor, he did not make a separate objection on behalf of Ms. Swan. However, it was clear that this was an issue that applied to both of them. And since there were two counsel, I believe it was clear to the judge that this objection was being made on both of their behalf. And I would just emphasize, Your Honor, that this gets into an area that is of great concern, and that is, even if he was an agent, which, you know, he stated he wasn't, that we would get into an attorney-client breach here. And, you know, we believe that should be looked at very seriously. Your Honor, it's also Sheila Swan's position that allowing this in, the reason it was so damaging was because in that statement, which Mr. Marzewski, of course, denied even making, it was stated that they had...
Who denied making it?
Mr. Marzewski, the attorney.
He was called as a witness?
No, he was not. He later submitted in the motion for new trial, submitted an affidavit.
But there was nothing in the trial to indicate to the end. He said, I'm kind of late by coming in with an affidavit. You wanted him to say that. All you had to do was call him during the trial.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe the defendant is required to rebut evidence that
never
should have been allowed in.
But it isn't a matter of rebuttal. It's a matter of facing the evidence. Mm-hmm. They said he said that. If you say he didn't say it, the time to call him was during the trial.
Your Honor, I'm going to move on to another error that we believe occurred. And that was the error regarding the limitations placed upon another witness that the defendant did attempt to call. That was Attorney McKelvey. And specifically, the government's theory was that...
Waive this issue?
I don't believe that was waived, Your Honor.
And if it weren't waived, which... What would Mr. McKelvey have added if he'd been permitted to testify? I mean, however complex the Medicare regulations may be, could anyone reasonably think, as my brother, Judge Bauer, noted, that the regulations permit a firm to bill the government for ghost services?
No,
performed by ghost employees?
Well, what Mr. McKelvey could have testified to was that Medicare does not base its reimbursement on job descriptions. One of the government's main points here was that a job description was used for one of these employees that did not mirror the duties that she performed. She was one of the employees who did perform some services. He would have testified that the actual job description is really irrelevant in terms of Medicare providing reimbursement. that Medicare provides reimbursement based on what is done and not on any sort of job description. And, in fact, the amount that was put in for that employee was cut to about 50% based on the duties that she had performed. So in that case, Mr. McKelvey's testimony would have been relevant. Your Honor, I would submit that in the end, it was the revelation of an attorney-client confidence made during casual conversation that was unrelated to the document subpoena that that was really the only and strongest evidence that Sheila Swan, and again, I emphasize this, yes, the company submitted those reimbursements. There is a possible explanation of negligence or mistake, but that Sheila Swan had no involvement in the cost report preparation of them or submission of them, and that the government provided no evidence of that. If there's no further questions, I respectfully ask this court to reverse the conviction of Sheila Swan and rely on my briefs. I'd be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Klein. Mr. Porter?
Your Honors, good morning. I will try to be brief. This was not IBM. This was not the CEO of Microsoft being charged criminally with knowledge and intent on a cost report submitted to the government. This was the co-owner of a company that she had put her heart and soul into, as she testified, that she owned with her husband, and that had roughly 10 employees. And had approximately no more than 10 employees in the office, and then they hired nurses who then went out to do home visits with people. In addition, there was an amazing amount of evidence, particularly about an employee named Betty Starling, who was this defendant's aunt, who this defendant had direct dealings with, who made an arrangement whereby Ms. Starling was put on the payroll by Ms. Swan, was sent checks, and those checks were used to pay a personal debt of Ms. Swan's. And then they sought reimbursement. A1, the company that she co-owned, sought reimbursement. So as to the substance of the charge and the substance of the intent, this was a simple case. This was a simple case, as Your Honors have grasped, of outright fraud and outright greed.
We grasp things occasionally here, almost by accident.
Had they not, as Your Honor noted, had they not sought reimbursement, they could have done whatever they wanted. They could have moved this money in whatever way they wanted. But the crime and the fraud was the seeking the reimbursement. But as Your Honor recognizes, there was waiver all up and down all of these arguments by this defendant, by Ms. Swan. She did not object to the question that she is now raising on appeal in terms of Mr. Marzuski. As to Mr. McElvey, she didn't ask any questions of him.
Speaking about Mr. Marzuski, the appellant says we should review the ruling on Mr. Marzuski for abuse of discretion rather than plain error because the issue was raised squarely in the motion for a new trial and that Judge St. Eve addressed the issue on its merits. What say ye to that assessment?
Ms. Swan raised that in her reply brief. I without citation to any law, to be able to bootstrap arguments that you waived by just raising them in a motion for new trial after the fact, my understanding of the law is you can't do that. And Judge St. Eve, when she was considering this, didn't consider, because it wasn't brought to her, issues of foundation or attorney-client privilege, the denial by Mr. Marzuski that he made those statements, because he did not testify at trial, which they certainly could have offered had they chosen to do so. It's the same thing with Mr. McElvey. They specifically disavowed the use of him as an expert. Her co-defendant did. She didn't ask any questions of him. And so to say Judge St. Eve abused her discretion is really unfair to Judge St. Eve. She didn't have a chance to abuse her discretion because it wasn't offered. That evidence wasn't offered. They didn't seek to introduce that evidence.
What was Mr. Swan's sentence?
It was a little bit less than Ms. Swan's. I believe it was 15 months. And Ms. Swan received a 22-month sentence. The guideline range was 21 to 27, and he was just a tad below it. I have my own theories about why that might have been, but Judge Saini didn't address the difference in the sentences. But, Your Honors, there was not error that occurred here, be it plain or otherwise, in any
What was done here to explore the attorney-client relation of this lawyer that made this statement?
What was done to explore it?
Yeah, and what was the obligation to do that? It's not very clear to me. What the obligation is or what was done to discharge it?
Well, what was done to discharge it was the explanation on the record was pretty short and pretty quick. We subpoenaed records about this quality management coordinator position, and we subpoenaed them in the care of the Swans and A1's then law firm, James Montgomery and Associates. We received back a response from one of Mr. Montgomery's associates, Tom Marzuski. And he said, no, there are no records, and gave the explanation that we then introduced into evidence. All of that was introduced at trial. I've not heard any discussion that he wasn't a lawyer in the James Montgomery firm, that we had the wrong guy or anything. We established the agent got a call from the lawyer after issuing the subpoena, and certain statements were made. I'm not sure that there's much more that we need to do if there isn't an issue raised about, well, wait a minute, there are some foundational issues with this because that lawyer isn't a lawyer in that firm or what have you. That wasn't contested below. So I think that we did discharge our obligation.
The issue was whether there was an attorney-client privilege that was being infringed.
Well, Your Honor, there was some mention of that in the briefs on appeal. Not during the trial. No, not at all. That issue was raised in the post-trial motions. The objection at trial was as to hearsay. That was the objection. In terms of the attorney-client privilege issue, I haven't researched this, but my view is if that statement is an admission and is a proper agent admission.
That's the Martin case.
And the fact that he made that statement, unless there's evidence otherwise, suggests that that was an intentional waiver, because there were strategic reasons why he might have made that statement and might have made that statement at the direction of his clients. So unless there is an issue that is then created that we then have to pursue, the fact of the statement, I think, suggests the waiver. Your Honors, if there's nothing else, I would ask that the decisions by Judge St. Eve below be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Klein.
Yeah, I think you asked a very important question when you asked what was done to explore the attorney-client relationship. And the answer to that is, Your Honor, nothing was done. And I believe that something should have been done because, as we know, a more exacting standard must be demanded for the admission of statements made by a lawyer. Now, when the objection was for hearsay, that's true, but that was discussed in terms of the foundation because it was only not hearsay if the attorney was an agent. It was only admitted as a statement of an agent. So, in other words, I would argue that the hearsay objection carried with it inherently the requirement that it be shown that that Mr. Marzewski was an agent. That was not done. I think counsel just conceded that that was not done. In fact, the only statement made was by the agent who said, well, I thought he was. He was at that law firm. He was one who responded to the subpoena. But we know, and there's ample case law, that simply responding to the document subpoena does not make him an agent for all purposes. So, Your Honor, I don't believe that the issue is waived. I believe that the hearsay objection encompassed in it and the following discussion in the court encompassed very clearly the fact that no foundation had been laid for the admission of that statement. And with that, I would simply conclude by saying that the combination, Mr. Porter points out, yes, this wasn't IBM or Microsoft. It was a small company, and yet, even within a very small company, there are roles and there is expertise. Sheila Swan did not have the expertise regarding the preparation of cost reports or have any knowledge really regarding reimbursement. That was not done by her. There was no evidence that was done by her. And therefore, the admission of that statement, which seemed to show some sort of intent, was very damaging and allowed the government to bolster its case through evidence that should have been inadmissible. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.